And a single judge can decide a refusal to certify. Looks like time is nearly up for me, and you've probably had enough of procedure on interlocutory appeals. Determination of the appeal, they can set aside the decision, they can send it back with orders. And it, when you read the decisions, in my view, they're pretty robust, they're pretty quickly done. They're relatively short compared with the usual Court of Appeal judgments. And for what it's worth, I think it's working reasonably well.
That has gone down in history at bar dinners as one of the worst speeches of all time. So it's with some trepidation that we launch into this morning's topic, which is the Criminal Procedure Act of 2009. I don't know whether all of you have gone out and purchased it. If you do, you will see that it is a fairly complete document that now incorporates in one act the relevant criminal procedure for all proceedings involving criminal matters, both magistrates court, county court, and trial, I should say, and appellate divisions. The Act was passed by the State Parliament in 2009, and in November of last year, the transitional provisions were passed, which enabled the Act to commence on the 1st of January of this year. The transitional provisions provide in Schedule 4 what procedures apply in relation to proceedings in the Magistrates Court, both summary and committals, and in trials and in appeals, in relation to matters which were commenced before the 1st of January. So in terms of summary hearings and committal procedures, if the proceedings were commenced before the 1st of January of this year, the old procedures apply, although there is the odd exception. For instance, just by way of example, the Criminal Procedure Act for committals introduces in section 145 a provision which means that if a person is committed to stand trial and they're also charged with summary offences, whereas in the past those summary offences were simply adjourned off to a date to be fixed and in some instances never came back on, now they are transferred if they're deemed to be related offences to the offences upon which a person's been committed. They get transferred to the court to which that person is committed. That now applies even though you may be conducting a committal proceeding under the old provisions. If the person was committed to stand trial before the 1st of January, the old procedures for trials under the Crimes Criminal Trials Act and those procedures that are still were previously in the Crimes Act still apply. If a person was sentenced before the 1st of January of 2010, the procedures for criminal appeals, including the division of the Crimes Act that apply to appeals to the Court of Appeal, apply. But once we are dealing with proceedings after the 1st of January in relation to charges laid after that time, or a person is committed after that time, or a person is sentenced after that time, we fall into the realm of this Act. Now, in the time available to us this morning, if we were to try and attempt, at least, to go through the various changes that have been brought about by the Criminal Procedure Act, we just simply couldn't do it. What we've chosen to do is to focus on some specific areas, and the first is in relation to what is a unique change, first in terms of appeals in Victoria introduced by this Act, and that is interlocutory appeals. Previously, under the Crimes Act, a person who was convicted could only appeal upon conviction. If you weren't convicted, of course, you're acquitted. You didn't have to appeal. But in the course of a trial, the judges make rulings. But in terms of those rulings, you could only ever appeal against an error made in the course of those rulings if you were convicted. That's been changed by this Act. And our first speaker today is Trevor Raitt. Trevor signed the bar roll back in 1995, And Trevor has a very extensive experience in trial practice and also an extensive experience in appellate advocacy, as well as doing a number of inquests. He is very well versed and very well placed to speak to you this morning about this radical change in terms of appeals by the introduction of interlocutory appeals. So at this stage, can we invite Trevor Raitt to speak to you about interlocutory appeals. And I understand you've got a handout, which I also understand contains a paper that he has put together in relation to this topic. Trevor, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Stephen. When we were asked to deal with this topic, as Stephen's already pointed out, my eyes glazed over a little bit. And when I looked at the topics that we had set out for these four breakfast seminars on criminal law, we thought we'd drawn the short straw. But it is an area which may be viewed as fairly dull and routine, criminal procedure. And indeed, in my day, when I started doing magistrates' court work, running round to Broadmeadows, Frankston, Dandenong, day in, day out, my idea of criminal procedure was how to get the clerk to move me from Peter Mealy to Phil Goldberg. And probably is your experience as well, as solicitors who do that day in, day out. The changes to the summary procedure we're not going to deal with. It's something that certainly I don't do, and it's probably something that you do a lot more of than us up here today. And I know there's significant changes in the summary stream, but we will leave that for you to teach us about as time goes on. In relation to interlocutory appeals, before we deal with the six sections in the Act, 295 to 301, just a bit of background. Section 199 of the Act, some of you will of course be familiar with, and that is a section which deals with the court making any orders and other decisions before trial. And so it's can be issues of law, issues of fact, or mixed fact and law, or any other issue in respect to the trial. So that might be a stay application, separate trial, etc. Section 199 was based on old parts of the old Section 5 of the Crimes Criminal Trials Act, but also incorporates what was 391A of the Crimes Act, and that was the section that dealt with determination of questions of law before trial, which has now been repealed. As will be discussed and is outlined in the paper, interlocutory appeals provisions in the Act make it easier to bring an interlocutory appeal before trial than during the running. There's a number of hurdles, of course, to do it before trial, but there's even more if something happens during the trial. It's a very difficult task to get it to the Court of Appeal. So there's an obvious relationship between 199 and the sections that deal with the interlocutory appeals. The benefit of bringing it an appeal before trial is obvious and deliberately designed to identify and deal with issues before trial that will hopefully prevent the long-delayed process that we're all well aware of in relation to dealing with the Court of Appeal after trial. The Attorney-General, in the second reading speech in relation to the Act, said that an interlocutory appeal may be brought if the judge who made the decision provides the necessary certification and the Court of Appeal provides leave to hear the appeal. The tests for certification and leave encourage the resolution of issues before a trial commences. Good preparation by the parties and case management by the court will identify most interlocutory appeal issues before trial commences. So the intention of Parliament, the intention of the Act, is not really to deal with these issues as they arise during a trial, but to deal with them before. It is possible, and I'll go through those sections later, it's possible, of course, to bring an interlocutory appeal once the trial has commenced, but as is apparent, that's to be avoided if possible, and the Act encourages that to be avoided. There's obvious examples, and you'll all have your own ones you can think of, where the possibility of an appeal of a point that it was decided before trial could have dramatically changed what would happen in that trial. The obvious example that I thought of, which was also raised by the President of the Court of Appeal, Chris Maxwell, in a speech that he gave last year before the Act came into operation, is that of Jack Thomas. The prosecution of Jack Thomas for terrorism-related offences relied pretty much entirely on a record of interview conducted by the Australian Federal Police while he was in custody in Pakistan. Prior to the trial commencing, the judge ruled that the admissions in the interview had been made voluntarily and that the record of interview was admissible in the trial. Thomas, as you know, was subsequently convicted. On appeal, the Court of Appeal unanimously held the confession was not voluntary and the record of interview was inadmissible. And that would have, without doubt, resulted in an acquittal being entered. Unfortunately, as some of you are aware, in between the trial and the appeal, Mr. Thomas gave an interview to the ABC and said some incriminating things which were relied on to cause a retrial. Had he not done that, there's no doubt he would have been acquitted. Thankfully, at the retrial, he was represented by the great Jim Kennan, who was the chairman of our list at the time, and he was acquitted of the terrorism offences on his second trial. If the defence had the opportunity to come to the court when the trial judge ruled the record of interview as being admissible, there is no doubt there would not have been a trial at all. And of course, we can now do that. Another example is that of the case of Wei Tang, the sex slavery trials. There were two lengthy trials. The Court of Appeal was involved. Ultimately, there were questions, fundamental threshold questions about the interpretation of new law, and the provisions of the code had not been dealt with. Ultimately, there were convictions in that case, and it went to the High Court and came back to the Court of Appeal, where the Court of Appeal dealt with a sentencing appeal. But in that case, Maxwell, Vincent and Buchanan said that it is to be hoped that the new provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act 2009, introducing interlocutory appeals and greatly expanding the case stated procedure, will enable questions of fundamental importance to a trial to be decided and, where necessary, considered by this court before the trial begins. And in that case, clearly there were fundamental questions which may well have changed the course of that trial. There may not have been two trials, and it may not have had to have gone to the High Court. In the paper I provided, just perhaps one other quote that's relevant at this stage is, in a recent interlocutory appeal of Stannard and the DPP, I think I've reproduced the quote from Justice Redlich at 7.3, page 4 of the report of the paper. Primarily, the interlocutory appeals process is designed to reduce the number of retrials and the overall pressure on the justice system by allowing a contentious interlocutory decision to be considered by the Court of Appeal prior to the commencement or conclusion of the trial. Before granting a certificate, a trial judge should consider whether the question certified is capable of serving that overriding purpose. And when one looks at section 297 of the Act, which is the matters that the Court of Appeal deals with when deciding to grant leave, 297(1)(b) really is the nub of the intention of the legislation. Will it render the trial unnecessary? Will it substantially reduce the time required for the trial? Will it resolve an issue of law to conduct the trial that's necessary, or reduce the likelihood of a successful appeal? So clearly, those cases that I've outlined to you and the legislation and the second reading speech make it very clear that this is an issue, this is a body of legislation that's designed to nip things in the bud, to get rid of records of interview, questions, stay applications, matters that could end a trial, reduce the time of a trial, obviously eliminate the chance of a retrial and an appeal. And the Court of Appeal have also said that they would rather deal with one ground of appeal that has some legs than six or seven at the end of a trial, which is what happens when we get to do a matter in the Court of Appeal. Most of us haven't got the guts to put one ground of appeal. I think Holdenson does. But inevitably there will be other grounds that you find, and it becomes a large case. It gets heard 2 years after the trial. And if there's any real point that can be taken, it should and can now be taken before trial. New South Wales has had interlocutory appeals in criminal cases since 1987. It's dealt with under Section 5F of their Criminal Appeal Act. On average, from my brief research, they have about 30 to 35 interlocutory appeals a year, which isn't a great deal given the size of their jurisdiction. And of those, there is only a handful where leave is given on points that are on rulings that have happened during the course of a trial. So again, it's very difficult to get an appeal up once the trial has started. The evidence is that they've been effective in New South Wales in reducing the rate of retrials. Speaking to some of my mates in chambers who do a lot more appeal work than I do, I asked them whether of the matters that they're familiar with, of those matters where a conviction appeal has resulted in an acquittal or indeed resulted in a nolly being entered or a satisfactory resolution of the case, based on a decision that may have been able to be made before the trial. And look, it's very hard to quantify, but the view was about 10 or 15% of cases would fall into that category, and therefore you would expect that had those points been able to be taken, that will reduce the load of appeals and retrials by about that figure. So it's clear that what the intention of the legislation is, and if I can turn to the paper that you've got before you, I won't go through it and read it to you, you can do that yourselves. When preparing this, it would be easy to just go to case after case and talk about the facts and what happened. What I've done is outline what I think or I hope would be relevant to you as solicitors, that is relevant law, rules, regulations and practice notes, and there's a bit more than I thought there would be when I started looking. It's not just a case of a barrister in a trial disagreeing with the judge's ruling and saying, right, we're going over the road. There is a number of steps you need to take. There are practice notes, there are rules, and I'll take you through those briefly. Going back though to the beginning of the paper, the right of appeal applies to proceeding in the county court or the trial division of the Supreme Court. It relates to what is an interlocutory decision, which is defined in Section 3 of the Act as a decision made by a judge in a proceeding referred to in Section 2951, whether before or during the trial, including a decision to grant or refuse a permanent stay of the proceeding. it's a very broad definition and was deliberately framed in that way to avoid what's happened in New South Wales, where interlocutory appeals are defined as an interlocutory judgment or order, and that has resulted in a great deal of scrutiny and uncertainty about what that means, and so there's been another hurdle in New South Wales to decide to often define whether what happened in the court was an interlocutory judgment or order. Here, it can be virtually anything, although, again, talk behind the scenes suggests that the Court of Appeal may seek to define that definition more narrowly if people just go over the road for insignificant or trivial matters. Looking then at the rules, obviously the Criminal Procedure Act is the starting point. There's only six sections there that deal with interlocutory appeals, but they provide a number of hurdles. And I've done it probably chronologically. Firstly, you need to look at the County Court Criminal Procedure Rules, and Rule 2.12 deals with interlocutory appeals. If you request certification from the judge under 2953, it's got to be in a form as required by the rules, Form 2H. There is a practice note which has been produced by the County Court. Paragraphs 112 of that to 117 of that practice note deal with the interlocutory appeals process and then effectively repeated in paragraphs 118 to 122 in relation to interlocutory appeals or points that are taken during the trial. But the process is relatively similar as far as the County Court is concerned. If you identify an issue, if a party, now a party can be defence or the Crown, if they identify an issue that should be dealt with as a pre-trial ruling and the issue is one that may lead to an interlocutory appeal, then that party should notify the other party and the registry. So way back at directions hearing, you think that there's an issue about the record of interview, it's at that point you're meant to notify the other party and the registry and say, look, this is going to result in a possible interlocutory appeal. So you can't just keep it to yourself anymore. It should be raised at the directions hearing. Once an interlocutory decision is made and a party proposes to apply for an interlocutory appeal against the decision, the party must advise the registry. So at the previous stage, you should, here you must. Request for certification must be filed with the registry, and that obviously links in with Rule 2.12. If the judge certifies, the person who obtains it must notify the registry and then must keep on notifying the registry of the filing of the application with the Court of Appeal. And if the Court of Appeal makes orders, you must inform the registry of that as well. The party files an application to review a judge's refusal to certify. Again, you must notify the registry and the judge's associate. Once you get up to the Court of Appeal, there are the Supreme Court Criminal Procedure Rules. It's now dealt with under Order 3. again, a form needs to be filled out, Form 63A. You've got to state in precise terms the grounds on which you seek to appeal. And the same sort of process for a refusal to certify, just different forms and different rules. And of course, you've got to file with that an affidavit stating the acts, facts, matters and circumstances relating to the order under appeal and the grounds why leave should be granted. As to procedure and time limits, there's obviously two main hurdles that are obvious. One is you've got to get certification by the judge. So the decision is made, you notify everyone about what you're doing, that you then ask the judge to certify that it is a matter suitable for the Court of Appeal. Pardon me, that those the certification must take into account section 295(3)(a), B or C. And an interlocutory decision concerns, if it concerns the admissibility of evidence, the judge needs to certify that if it's ruled inadmissible, it would eliminate or substantially weaken the prosecution case. If it's not about the admissibility of evidence, that it's of sufficient importance. to justify it being determined by an interlocutory appeal. And there's been a couple of those. I'll deal with one in a moment. You would think that, on average, most of the decisions would be about the admissibility of evidence, but of course you do have commonly applications to permanently stay, applications to sever counts, or separate trial applications. There's a couple of examples I've just noted there. Aidan and the Queen, I've spelt that wrong, it should be A-Y-D-I-N, which was a permanent stay application. And then there's an interesting case you may have heard about or read about of GP and the Queen. That was a application where a judge refused to disqualify herself for bias. We probably shouldn't mention the judge's name. Oh, but there it is, Judge Jenkins on the front of the report. We are allowed to mention names. Judge Jenkins had a defendant before her who was probably a little disorganised, didn't have funds in trust for a solicitor. She got a bit tired of that and said, if you don't put funds in, I'm going to revoke your bail, which she did. And there seemed to be no reason to do that other than that she was annoyed with him. It went, ultimately, her barrister was briefed. Barrister asked her to disqualify herself. Judge Rosines promptly granted bail, and the matter came before the court as an interlocutory decision. And I suppose for the purpose of this talk, paragraph 44 of that decision talks about whether this was an appropriate interlocutory decision based on 2953B. They decided that it was, and said, referring to another case of Ashley, Justice Ashley wrote this judgment, he referred to another case where he said, that is a matter for this court to consider afresh, ordinarily on the material adduced below, and not ignoring the conclusion reached by the judge below. But in this case, there is a threshold question. It is whether the decision by the judge not to recuse herself was an interlocutory decision. It is convenient to deal with that matter at the outset. He said that it appears to me that the interlocutory decision was of sufficient importance to the trial to justify it being determined on an interlocutory appeal. The judge, it must be said, did not in terms address herself to the subsection when refusing to certify. As I have noted, she said only that she did not think the Court of Appeal would consider an interlocutory appeal. That, with respect, did not focus upon the language of 2953B at all. For my part, the decision of a judge not to recuse himself or herself on a ground of apprehended bias ought to be regarded as being of sufficient importance to the trial to justify it being determined on an interlocutory appeal. That is, assuming always that the application to recuse is one serious in its content rather than merely frivolous. Here, on no view could the latter description attach. So they viewed it very seriously, her behaviour with this particular defendant, and it was a matter that was suitable under 2953B to be dealt with. So the definition of interlocutory decision is wide, and that matter was serious, according to Justice Ashley in the Court of Appeal, and it was sent back to the court with directions that she not hear the trial in the future. In terms of time limits, notice needs to be filed within 10 days after the day on which the interlocutory decision was made. That will be fairly easy when it's back at directions hearing. If the trial commences within 10 days after the day of the decision, then you only have 2 days. Now, that may happen, there might be an application at a final directions hearing which could occur a week out from the trial. An example would be if the trial starts before the eighth day of after the decision is made, then you're then down to 2 days to get your appeal in. Extension of time can be granted under section 313, as with any appeal. And at the end of the paper there, I've just listed, other relevant provisions. These are not provisions in the division for interlocutory appeals, but apply to interlocutory appeals. That is section 313, extension of time, 314, how to abandon, 317, production of documents, exhibits, other things, examination of witnesses. I haven't listed them all there, but these are relevant matters which apply equally to interlocutory appeals. As to the other hurdles, decisions made before trial, leave can only be given by the court if it's satisfied that it's in the interest of justice to do so, taking into account those matters that I alerted you to earlier in 297. So there is quite a strict leave process, and reading the decisions that have come out, some don't get leave, and often a large part of the argument in the Court of Appeal is dealing with leave and not just let's hear the substantive matter and we'll deal with leave in the running. The court is applying the leave gateway quite strictly. They need to take into account the level of disruption to the trial and the extent to which the hearing will reduce subsequent time needed. A decision made during a trial adds a couple of additional hurdles. Firstly, your time limit's down to 2 days. In addition to the matters that need to be considered for certification, so you've got those first, the judge dealing with it at first instance must also certify that the issue could not have been identified before trial. So if it's an obvious one that you just thought of because you didn't prepare it or it just came up and you hadn't thought about it, you'll have that hurdle. Or if it could have been identified before trial, that the party wanting to appear was not at fault. So there may be a change of instructions or something like that where that you can satisfy the judge. And that's dealt with in 2953. There's an error there in the paper. It should be sub C, not A and B. For leave to be granted, so if you do get over that hurdle and you get to the Court of Appeal, for leave to be granted after the trial has commenced, in addition to the matters that the court must deal with in 297, which I went through, whether it's going to render the trial unnecessary, etc., the Court of Appeal must also not give leave unless the reasons for doing so clearly outweigh any disruption to the trial. So it's very difficult and a lot of hurdles to get over to run a matter during the running of a trial. You can review a refusal to certify. That was obviously the case with the Judge Jenkins matter. That's dealt with under 296. And rather than time limits are the same, court must consider the matters that the original judge would have considered under 2953 in order to certify. And again, to fast track the matter, the remedy is not to send it back or to substitute certification. That's all just put aside. They'll either grant leave or they won't. But the court must consider the matter afresh. And clearly that's done to move the matter along quickly rather than to send it back to the judge. And a single judge can decide a refusal to certify. Looks like time is nearly up for me and you've probably had enough of procedure on interlocutory appeals. Determination of the appeal. They can set aside the decision, they can send it back with orders. When you read the decisions, in my view, they're pretty robust, they're pretty quickly done. They're relatively short compared with the usual Court of Appeal judgments, and for what it's worth, I think it's working reasonably well. You must also remember that the Appeals Costs Act has been amended to include interlocutory appeals. You can get your costs like you would in any other appeal. A successful applicant in their own appeal, just as any other case where the accused should not be made to pay for mistakes that have led to additional costs. And of course, in a Crown appeal, you'll get your costs win or lose, as you would with a Crown appeal on sentence. In the paper, behind the paper, you'll see a couple of flow charts, which I found pretty helpful. When I was researching a bit more about the Act, I got a hold of this book here, the Criminal Procedure Act Legislative Guide. Those flow charts are taken out of this book. I found it's pretty dense, but it's reasonably helpful when you work through it. It's not something you'd take to court, and some of you may already have it, but it's background material, legislative history on each section, and comparisons with other sections that have been before, or other procedures that have been before. It's relatively helpful, and there's a lot of those flow charts in relation to other parts of the Act as well. So I would recommend having a look at that. So thank you very much.